Okay, so we're going to pick up from where we left off the last day. And I will read it and just comment as we go along. Is that all right?
Yeah.
The way I do this is that if I read it slowly and meaningfully and prayerfully, the Lord illuminates me and I illuminate you. It's a good method. And it doesn't matter how much I prepare it, I still get something when I'm reading it. It's really amazing. So, for example, Louisa said, if I woke up in the morning, now she's talking about a time when the Lord is teaching her a lot of mortification and self-discipline. If I didn't get up immediately, she said, the interior voice would tell me, you rest, and I had no other bed but the cross. Now, I know you don't use the snooze button or anything, you know, when your alarm clock goes off. But what the Lord was asking her is as soon as she woke up, that she was to have the discipline of actually getting out of bed. That's very difficult, unless it's the end of the world or something. I would find that difficult. I don't know about you. So if I walked and my sight would run a little further, he would immediately reprimand me. I don't want this. You're to let your sight, you're not to let your sight move away, but the length of your step so that you won't trip. If I was in the countryside and I saw flowers and trees, he would say to me, I've created everything for love of you, and you deprive your sight of this pleasure for love of me. Even the most innocent and holy things, as for example, the cloths for the altars, the processions, he would say to me, you must take no pleasure but in me alone. If I was sitting while working, he would say to me, you're too comfortable. Don't you remember that my life was a continuous suffering and you? In order to content him, I would immediately shift, watch the sense of humour coming out, to half the chair, leaving the other half empty. And sometimes jokingly, I'd say to him, see, Lord, the other half's for you. Come and sit near me. I'll give you a comment when I've just read this section. Sometimes it seemed that he would content me, and I felt such delight that I myself cannot express it. Sometimes then, when I was working a little slowly and listlessly, her work was mostly crochet, needlework, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
He would say to me, hurry up, hurry up, hurry yourself. For the time you gain by helping yourself, you will spend with me in prayer. Sometimes he himself would assign to me how much work I was supposed to do, and then I would pray him to come and help me. Yes, yes, he would say, we will do it together. Now, this is the first we in the whole thing. Up to now, it's he says this and I respond. Mm. This is the we, the shift from I to we. We will do it together so that when you have finished, we will be more free. Now, notice the claim on union that's actually there. And it would happen that in 1 hour or two, I did what I was supposed to do for the whole day. And then I would go to pray, and he gave me such light, which is enlightenment or understanding, and told me many things such that it would be too long for me to say them all. Now, why is he telling her she has to live such a restricted life? You're not to smell the flowers. You're not to look down the street to see what, you're only to look one step ahead. What is he preparing her for? He's preparing her for the fact that she will have to make an unbelievable sacrifice of sitting in a bed for 64 years. At this moment, she doesn't know that's what's being asked of her. All she knows is that the parameters of her life are dwindling, and she's being brought down to a much smaller space to get used to a much smaller space so that he can work with her. And she accepts this discipline. Now, is he asking the same thing of you? The answer is no. You're not called to the sacrifice that was asked of her. So what you apply to yourself in this is the discipline of generosity in everyday life, that you're not indulging yourself in everything you do. Just the ordinary discipline is actually required of us. So the next paragraph, the heading I put on it is The Lord Provides, Yahweh Jireh, The Lord Provides. I remember that while I was alone working, I noticed that the thread was not enough to finish that work and that I would need to go to my family in order to get some more. So I said to him, what's the purpose of having helped me, my beloved? As I see that I need to go to my family, I may find people who may prevent me from coming back here. And this time our conversation will come to nothing. What? He said to me. Don't you have faith? Yes, Louisa said. Well then, have no fear, for I will make you complete everything. And so it happened. The thread just kept going. So she's learning to depend on him absolutely. Now the thing is, the Lord will do it for you as well if you come up with the same trust. I had an eye-opening experience in Soweto in South Africa, which had a very bad name because of the media, giving you the impression that everybody in Soweto was a baddie. There's only 3 million people in Soweto. They're not all baddies. I absolutely loved being there. And the parish that I was in, there was 24 hours adoration. The church never closed. And there was never more than 20 or 25 people at adoration, morning, noon and night. It was absolutely incredible. The priest told me he was so happy he was praying that the bishop would forget he was there. But their mass on a Sunday went on for 3 hours. So I attended two of these masses and had 6 hours of liturgy for the morning because I was speaking at the masses. And at the end of the second one, the priest said to me, we're inviting you for a special experience. I said, oh, that's fine. He said, come and have lunch. I thought, what's so special about lunch? You know what I mean? But you see, what was so special about lunch was that at the offertory, they brought in the chickens with the legs tied, and they brought in the vegetables, and they brought in the fruits, and they brought in everything. And lunch was whatever was offered at the offertory. So when we went out, there were the ladies cooking what was actually offered, and the double doors were opened, and there was a huge sign out towards the street, and it said, if you were not able to join us for the Eucharist, please join us for our agape meal. So the invitation was open to absolutely anybody. And I sat in that room from about 1 o'clock until about four and counted approximately 350 people coming for the meal. And the meal didn't finish until the last person offered their plate for food. And I said to the priest, you did not get enough food at that altar because I was there for 350 people. No, he said, you definitely didn't. He said, we have the multiplication of the loaves every single Sunday for the past 25 years. He said, we don't ask God for it. We just trust the people will bring the food. And he said, there's never enough. There was enough food for about 50 people offered today at Mass. And he said, it just kept multiplying. He said, they all say, Father, we're not going to eat until you bless it. We need your blessing to multiply this. And they have it all the time. And what I saw was people who had such a deep, simple trust in God, that God delighted in doing that. And we're so sophisticated, you see, we wouldn't even think about it. You know, that's the sadness on our part. Now, Louisa is being taught to have this very basic, simple trust in God. It's really wonderful. And so she learns on a very simple thing that your thread will multiply. But she's going to learn it on much higher things later on. So, in the next paragraph, Louisa is being prepared to be a victim soul. So the next lesson is total self-abnegation. You know what total self-abnegation is? It's total self-denial. Total, total, total. You're not looking for anything for yourself. If then at lunchtime I ate something tasty, he would immediately reprimand me interiorly, saying, have you perhaps forgotten that I had no other taste but suffering for love of you? And that you must have no other taste but mortifying yourself for love of me. Now, Louise isn't the only one that went down that road. I mean, St. Therese did, and most of the saints that I've read about. Leave it aside, he said, and eat that which you like the least. Is that the way you eat your lunch? And I would immediately take it and bring it to the maid. You can see that she's in a upper middle class family. I never lived with maids, did you? And I would say that I didn't want it anymore. And many times I remained almost on an empty stomach. However, when I would go to pray, I would receive so much strength and feel so satiated that I would feel nausea for everything. Now, what she's being taught is, you withdraw yourself from this natural food and I will feed you on supernatural food. This is the call to being a victim soul, where she will be feeding mostly on the Eucharist for most of her life. It's not what you and I are called to. Other times then, in order to contradict me, if I did not feel like eating, he would say to me, I want you to eat for love of me. This is simply self-denial. It's also human will surrendering to the divine will. And as the food unites with the body, pray, my love may unite with your soul. Everything will be sanctified. Now, is it the presence of the food or the absence of the food is the more holy? The answer is neither. What makes the presence or the absence of food holy is that you're surrendering to God's will. That's the issue. And that's what she's learning. And later on, when she gets into taking on the sufferings of Christ in reparation for the church and the world, she has to learn it's not the sufferings. It's whether God wants it or God doesn't want it. It's God's will is the issue. She's going to learn that the whole way through. So, in a word, without going any further, even in the smallest things, he tried to make my will die. There is the issue. Now, your will doesn't die, but you try to put it aside to let the divine will take over. So for that, I want to give you the New Testament full of die to self. 1 Corinthians 15:31 and Philippians 1:21. Philippians 1:21. We must die to self. So he tried to make my will die so that it might live only for him. So that means the human will gives way to let the divine will take over. You have to have a will, otherwise you can't live. But if the human will is completely dominant, then the divine will cannot take over and bring you to that divine level. When we try to surrender to the divine will, then he can raise us up to the level of the divine will. He allowed that I be contradicted also by the confessor. Now, the contradiction thing is merely not my will, but thine be done. And at the early stages of walking in the divine will, it's terribly important to take that as a motto, not my will, but thine be done. And the Lord will allow people to cross you, sometimes totally irrationally and everything. And you take your eyes off the persons who are doing that and you just say, yes, Lord, not my will, but thine. That is the issue. And all he's doing is exercising it. And if you want to become proficient in anything, you do have to exercise, as you know. So, for example, she said, I would feel a great need to receive Holy Communion. For the whole day and night, I would do nothing but prepare myself. My eyes could not close to sleep because of the continuous throbbing of my heart. Look at the love she has for God, her heart throbbing at the thought of Holy Communion. And I would say to him, Lord, hurry, for I cannot be without you. Accelerate the hours, let the sun rise quickly, for I cannot resist anymore. My heart is fainting. Now put beside that Psalm 63. O God, you are my God, for you I long, for you my soul is thirsting, even my body pines for you, like a dry, weary land without water. He himself would make such loving invitations that I would feel my heart, my text says, crack. We normally say break, but I'm not sure there's any difference. He would say to me, see, I am alone. Do not be troubled because you cannot sleep. This is about keeping company with your God. Now, here Louisa is being introduced to what is called solitude. Solitude is a very deep experience. The saints usually call it being alone with the alone. I hope your hours of adoration give it to you because it's a divine experience. And this is the beginning of her night vigils for the rest of her days. So, this is about keeping company with your God. Now, beside that also, I want you to put Proverbs 8:31. Proverbs 8:31. God delights to be with the children of men. And I want to give you Genesis 3:8 as well. Adam, where are you? I'm looking for you. Genesis 3:8 and Proverbs 8:31. So this is about keeping company with your God, with your spouse, with your all. And if he's the all, then there's nothing else. Who is continuously offended. Oh, please do not deny me this relief, because then in your afflictions, I will not leave you. He will keep that promise literally to her. But while I was in these dispositions in the morning, I would go to the confessor, and without knowing why, the first thing he would say to me is, I don't want you to receive communion. Oh dear, she's been preparing all night for it. Well, how about going against your will? Isn't that something? I tell you the truth, this was so bitter for me that sometimes I would do nothing but cry. Now, she's talking at a time when she was still a teenager, so the crying is understood. Later on, the crying isn't accepted. You have to grow up and carry the cross without the crying. I would not dare to say anything to the confessor because he himself wanted to do so. Otherwise, he would reproach me, and I would go to him and tell him of my pain. Ah, my good Lord, is this the vigil that we've kept last night, that after so much waiting and yearning, I was to remain deprived of you? I know well that I must obey, but tell me something. Can I be without you? So you're talking about someone in very deep union with God. Who will give me the strength? And then, who will have the courage to depart from this church without bringing you along? I don't know what to do, but you can remedy everything. While pouring myself out in this way, I would feel a fire draw near me. Now, that's the fire of God's love. And a flame enter my heart. Now, St. Therese also said that she experienced a real fire in her heart. She wasn't using a symbol. I would feel him within me, and immediately he would say to me, calm yourself, here I am, inside your heart. So has she received communion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's inside her heart.
The way we would say it traditionally is that she received spiritual communion. What do you fear now? But later on now, he will, in higher volumes, he will explain to her about living hosts as well, but I won't do it now. Do not afflict yourself anymore. I myself want to dry your tears. That's in Revelation 7:17. It's the promise of God to anybody who comes into the New Jerusalem. I will dry your tears myself. Revelation 7:17. You are right. You could not be without me, could you? Which is absolutely true. Then she said, I would remain so very annihilated. Now, my text says annihilated. Do you have a different word?
No.
No. It actually means humiliated. See, they use many archaic words in these translations. I would feel so very humiliated within myself, and I would say to him that if I were good, he would not have disposed it in that way, because she doesn't yet realise that the issue is simply contradicting her will so that she's exercised this way. And I prayed him never to leave me again, for I did not want to be without him. Now, this is the beginning of her terrible yearning for him that's going to crucify her throughout all of these volumes. It's a wonderful thing. So in the next paragraph, she begins her Via Dolorosa, and she discovers that it's a combination of love and pain that redeems the world. And that's what you find in great abundance in the hours of the Passion. So after these things, one day after communion, I felt him within me, all love. 1 John 4:7, God is love. 1 John 4:7. He was in me, all love. Loving me so much that I myself was very much amazed, as I saw myself so bad and not requiting. So beside that, I want you to put Isaiah 6:1-6. Isaiah 6:1-6. When Isaiah saw the glory of God in the temple, that was when he said, I am a man of unclean lips and I belong to a people of unclean lips. So when you see the glory of God, you then see what human nature is actually like. But if we're only comparing ourselves with each other, we're all grand. So, but if you see the glory of God, that's different. So I saw myself so bad, and non-requiting, that means not responding correctly to the level of grace that's given to me. And I said within myself, if only I were good and responding correctly, I fear that he may leave me. And then she puts in brackets, I've always had this fear that he might leave me, and I still do. And sometimes the pain I feel is so great that I believe that the pain of death would be minor. And if he himself does not come to calm me, I can give myself no peace. So that's just by the way. I fear that he may leave me while he wants to draw more intimately close to me. God does not see us the way we see ourselves. He sees us in absolute truth. We see ourselves with all the presuppositions and assumptions and everything else that we have about ourselves and about life and about everything. And we also don't see our faults and failings in perspective. So Louisa thinks she's a very great sinner here, and in actual fact, the Lord is drawing her closer and closer to himself. And this is his choice. This is his choosing. That's why we call it vocation. It's a call. It's his choosing. He wants to draw more intimately close to me. While I felt him within me this way, through an interior voice, he said to me. Now, the interior voice is an interior locution. Now, later on, she'll explain the different ways that the Lord communicated with her. He said, my beloved, the things of the past have been nothing but a preparation. That means everything in your past life is simply a preparation for the call that's on your life at this moment. And it's terribly important for us to remember that. Because sometimes people think that if something awful happened to them in childhood, that that sort of stamps them for the rest of their days. It doesn't have to do that at all, unless you want to sit in the past and you want to glorify the past, but you've got to let the past go. So beside that, I want you to put Isaiah 43. Isaiah 43, verses 18 to 19. And Isaiah told the people, let the past go. Behold, I'm doing a new thing. And to let God do a new thing, you've got to let the past go. But if you hold on to the past, you're not going forward, are you?
No.
So that's why St. Therese says that we must go to God with empty hands. That you're not clinging to anything in the past or anything in the present. You are being completely open to let him do what he wants. So everything in the past has just been a preparation. Now I come to the facts. In order to dispose your heart to do what I want from you, that is the imitation of my life. Now here's the first time he tells her that she has to be an exact imitation of his life. That's not a tall order unless you know who he was and what kind of a life he had. So for putting the past behind you as well, Philippians 3:12, where St. Paul said, I put the past behind me and I race forward for the finish. Do you remember that text? Philippians 3:12. So Louisa is told that she must give complete imitation of Jesus' life. I want you to enter into the immense sea of my passion. Now, what he's going to do is, A, he's calling her to victimhood, that she is to be a victim soul and making reparation for others. But he is going to make a revelation about the passion to her that he never made to anybody else. She's the only one who got the revelation about the interior passion. After you have understood well the bitterness of my pains, the love with which I suffered them, see pain and love, who I am who suffered so much, and who you are, a most wretched creature, your heart will not dare to oppose the blows, the cross that I have prepared only for your good. So, most of us don't appreciate the crosses that the Lord allows to come to us in our lives, that train us, that cure us, that release us from the world, that catapult us into the divine. We don't really appreciate because we've had nobody to help us. And that's why these early volumes are so essential for giving us the spiritual direction that we were denied in our own lives. Mm-hmm. That's why this stuff is so valuable. And so instead of looking back at some time and saying, well, you know, I've had it pretty tough, you know, blah, 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 so happened to me. Instead of that, just say, look at the way the Lord prepared me to enter into the divine will. Because he's saying everything that you've experienced was for the call that's on your life. So on the contrary, by just thinking that I, your master, have suffered so much, your pains will seem shadows to you compared with mine. That's Romans 8:18. The sufferings of this life are nothing compared with the glory that God has prepared for us. So suffering will be sweet to you. Now that doesn't mean, suffering is never sweet. It doesn't mean he takes the pain out of it, not at all. But it means you will know the value of it, which is different. Again, coming back to the image of a woman giving birth, she doesn't enjoy the pain, but the pain is sweet because there's a child going to be born. And so she'll pay the price for the child. So just to give you kind of an understanding of what you mean by the pain is sweet, you're looking for the fruit that's going to come out of this. And there will be immense fruit coming out of Louisa's sufferings. Suffering will be sweet for you, and you will reach the point of not being able to be without suffering. Hebrews 12:2. For the joy that was ahead of him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. So Louisa said, my nature trembled at the mere thought of suffering. That's the way our human nature is. You're not supposed to enjoy it. I prayed that he himself would give me the strength, because without him, I would use his very gifts to offend the giver. Now, in the hours of the Passion, Jesus will explain that many people actually use the sacraments to offend him. So I gave all of myself to meditating on the Passion. Now, when Louisa says she gives all of herself, she actually means about 8 hours a day, not just her entire concentration. She really gives enormous time. I think it was 8 or 10 hours a day she did in the Christmas novena, for example. And this did so much good to my soul that I believed that all the good came to me from that source. I saw the Passion of Jesus Christ as an immense sea of light. Now, 1 John 1:5, God is light. The divine will in these writings will be called light, which wounded me all over. And I think the word wounded there is used in the sense touched me deeply, not in the English sense of wounding you as in damage. Touched me all over with his innumerable rays of patience, humility, obedience, and all the other virtues. I saw myself all surrounded by this light, and I remained humiliated at seeing myself so different from him. Those rays that inundated me were so many reproaches for me. I heard them say, a God so patient, and understood, what about you? A God so humble and submitted also to his very enemies, understood, and what about you? A God who suffers so much for love of you, and where are the sufferings that you have for love of him? You can see that she's being drawn in to be becoming a victim soul, making reparation for the church and the world. So the next paragraph is the vision that changed her whole life, and it's the conversion point for this woman. Sometimes he himself would make me the narration of the pain suffered by him, and I was so touched that I would cry bitterly. One day while working, so she's doing her crochet, her needlework, I was considering the most bitter pains that my good Jesus suffered. I felt my heart so oppressed by the pain that I couldn't breathe. Fearing something wrong, understood, I wanted to distract myself by going out onto the balcony, because you know that's the way buildings are in Italy. But as I go about looking in the middle of the street, what do I see? I see that the street all filled with people, and in the middle of it, my beloved Jesus with the cross upon his shoulders. Some pulled him to one side and some to another. All panting with his face dripping with blood, he raised his eye towards me and asked for help. Who can tell the sorrow I felt and the impression that a scene so pitiful made to my soul? Now, as you go through the hours of the Passion, every now and then Jesus will say to her, stay close and help me. And it's totally extraordinary that he asks us, because in those moments, he's asking the person doing the hour of the Passion to come and help him. And help him, of course, is that you do the reparation and you win souls for him. So he was asking for help. Who can tell the sorrow I felt and the impression that a scene so pitiful made on my soul? I immediately went inside. I myself did not know where I was. I felt my heart break with pain. I shouted, and crying, I said to him, my Jesus, if only I could help you. If only I could free you from those wolves so rabid. We would say those rabid wolves. Wolves so rabid is not English. I wish at least to suffer those pains in your place. Now, you see that the call to be the victim's soul is there. To give relief to my sorrow. Oh, please, my good, give me suffering. This is her first request as a victim soul. Give me suffering, for it's not fair that you should suffer so much while I, a sinner, remain without suffering. So the next paragraph is her desire for suffering. From that time onwards, I remember such a great yearning for suffering ignited within me. Now there's grace working overtime, that it has not dampened yet. I also remember that after communion, I would ardently pray him to concede me suffering. And sometimes to content me, he seemed to take the thorns from his crown and prick my heart. Other times I felt him take my heart in his hands and squeeze it so tightly that I felt faint with the pain. When I realized that people would notice something, and he was disposed to give me these pains, I would immediately say to him, Lord, what are you doing? I beg you to give me suffering, but let it be hidden from everybody else. But of course, you can't control God, can you? And you can't control the divine will, but we find it extremely difficult not to be in control. You know, you can do such and such a thing, but under such and such conditions. And she's going to find it hard, as we all do, to just let God be God. Up to a certain time, he made me content. In other words, he did what I wanted. Is that the way it's supposed to be? No, it's the opposite. But my sins have made me unworthy to suffer secretly without anybody noticing it. Now, Louisa does not know at this stage that she is called to receive a major revelation that the church must take on board, and that is going to guide the church from the third millennium onwards. She doesn't know that. It's going to take a long time for that to sink in. And when she realizes it, she's going to say to him, I must be hallucinating. This can't be true. So she said, I remember that many times after communion, he said to me, you will not be able to truly resemble me other than by means of sufferings. Now notice that the communication happens after communion. Why is that? He's physically present. Up until now, I have been together with you. Now I want to leave you alone a little bit. Oh dear. This is the beginning of what she calls her privation. Now, she's just merely reflecting on the past, filling in huge swathes. The details of how you get from one to another is not actually given. So this is the beginning of her privation that's going to crucify her for the rest of her life. Without letting myself be felt. But he's present all the time, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's present in the depths of our being. The Blessed Trinity indwells us, isn't that right? Mm-hmm. See, up to now, I have led you by the hand, instructing you and correcting you in everything, and you've done nothing but follow me. Now I want you to do it by yourself. And you say, excuse me, Lord, but I thought you said that without you I could do nothing. Mm-hmm. John 15:5. What he's doing is what a mother does when she puts the child on the floor and helps the child to take the first few steps. And then she pulls the hands back and says, try one yourself. Mm-hmm. But the hands are always there to grab you if you're falling. Yeah. So I want you to take a few steps by yourself. However, Be more attentive than before, thinking that my gaze is fixed on you. Psalm 34, verse 15. Psalm 34, verse 15. Though I do not let myself be heard, and that when I return to make myself heard, I will come either to reward you if you have been faithful, or to chastise you if you've been ungrateful. So I want to give you Proverbs 15:3. Now, what Jesus has said to Louisa very simply there is the way God comes to the earth. He comes in mercy. He gives you an opportunity to respond. If you absolutely reject, the next coming is judgment. So Jesus has been coming in mercy to Louisa. Now he gives her a task to do, and he says, if you don't do it, I will come as a judge. It's just the way God works. So the next paragraph, my heading for that is deep foundations. Louisa said, I was so frightened and terrified at such intimidation, is what she called her comments about Jesus as we go along. It's just absolutely hilarious. Imagine saying that God intimidates us, you know. That I said to him, Lord, my all and my life, how can I survive without you? Now, what she means is his visible presence. What she wants all the time is his visible presence, because he's there invisibly anyway, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Who will give me the strength? How is it after you've made me leave everything? You remember all the exercise about coming away from the world? So much that I feel as if no one existed for me. You want to leave me alone and abandoned. What? Have you perhaps forgotten how bad I am, and without you I can do nothing? Do you see the quotation? Yeah. John 15:5, that's exactly out of the Gospel. And because of this objection, assuming a more serious look, he said to me, the reason is that I want you to understand well who you are. You're a nothing, you're a nobody, and you're dealing with the Almighty, okay? See, I do this for your good. Do not be saddened. I want to prepare your heart to receive graces which I have designed for you. John 14:1-4. In my Father's house there are many mansions, and there's one for you. Now, a mansion is full of goodies. Up until now, I have assisted you sensibly. Now I will do it less sensibly. Oh, the scripture says the just man lives by faith. Isn't that right? Yeah, don't try that on Louisa. I will make you touch your nothingness with your own hands. Now, nothingness is one of the big things in this divine will adventure. Up to the time when the Lord created Louisa, humility was accepted as one of the greatest of the virtues. But in the divine will, in the higher volumes, he says, even humility won't get into heaven. He said, you've got to go much further than that. You've got to go into your nothingness. That the Lord wants us to go into this nothingness, where there is literally nothing of yourself, so that the Lord can do what he did in creation, which is to create out of nothing. That's his thing. He creates out of nothing. If there's even a bit of ourselves there, we block what he really wants to do. So I will fuse you thoroughly in profound humility in order to be able to build high walls about you. So instead of afflicting yourself, you should rejoice and thank me, because the faster I make you cross the stormy sea, the sooner you will reach the port of safety. He is bringing her through a crash course in sanctity. Normally, what he's doing with her in a very short time, he normally takes years to do with anybody else. And the harder the trials to which I submit you, the greater the graces you will receive. Courage then, courage, and I will come back soon. And in saying this, he seemed to, I love the way she says, he seemed to bless me, and he went. Because as far as Louise is concerned, you know, disaster starts at this moment, you know. So let's do the next paragraph, which is resignation is step one. And when things are pretty difficult, then resignation is difficult as well. So resignation is the first step. Who can tell what pain I felt, the void he felt in my interior, the bitter tears I shed, but I resigned myself. That's the first lesson learned. I resigned myself to his holy will. It seemed that from afar I kissed the hand that which blessed me, saying to him, goodbye, O holy spouse, goodbye. I felt as if everything was over for me because I had only him. And since he was missing, no other consolation was left to me. Rather, everything turned into the most bitter pains. Even more, creatures themselves would provoke my pain in such a way that all the things I would look at seemed to be saying to me, see, you are the works of my beloved, but where is he? Now, Psalm 42, I have nothing but tears for my bread night and day, as they say to me all day long, where is your God? Psalm 42. If I looked at the water, the fire, the flowers, and even the stones, immediately my thought would say, ah, these are the works of your spouse. They have the good of seeing him, but you don't see him. Oh, please, works of my Lord, give me the news. Tell me, where is he? He told me he would come soon. Now, as far as Louise is concerned, if Jesus said he's coming soon, that's in the next half hour. Mm-hmm. That's not tomorrow. It's not next week. You know, and it's really incredible. As we go from here on in volume one, the Song of Songs is all over the place. Louisa is actually experiencing the Song of Songs, and it puts Song of Songs 5-6 there. My beloved has disappeared and I have to search the place looking for him. I'll do Song of Songs 5-6. So the next paragraph is about dryness in prayer. At times I would reach such a bitter desolation that I would feel breathless, ice cold all over, and a shiver through my whole person. Sometimes my family would notice it. They attributed to a physical trouble and wanted to put me under treatment and call the doctors. Sometimes they insisted so much that they succeeded, but I would do as much as I could to remain alone. So they noticed it only a few times. I remembered still all the graces, the words, the corrections, the reproaches, and I could see with a clear eye how all the work done until then, everything had been the work of his grace. Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. Ephesians 2:10. And that there was nothing left of myself but mere nothing and inclination to evil. She's making progress so fast. It's absolutely astonishing. I could touch with my own hand how without him I could no longer feel love so sensibly and those lights so clear during meditation, such that I would remain there for 2 or 3 hours. However, I did as much as I could in order to do whatever I used to do when I felt him within me, because I felt these words being repeated in me. If you are faithful, I will come to reward you. If you're ungrateful, I'll chastise you. Now, she says something major there, and that is that when you're going through a time of dryness, you must not stop doing the prayer you did when you were fervent. Because if you stop the prayer that you did when you were fervent, you're showing you don't love God, that you were just getting satisfaction out of the prayer for yourself. I'm going to stop there because of the time. And we'll take it up. And next week is the last one before Christmas.